Blog Talk Radio.
I knew we met each other this morning for a reason. Thinking, talking, we've worked out our problems. Looked like we should have better days in front. Just because we took our time to think and talk. For a much better understanding.
In my
understand where y'all coming from. Y'all coming from my four-cornered room. Yeah.
Brother, sister, other celestial energies, brother, wisdom, what's going on, guys? Let's talk about the New World Order. New World Order. A lot of our people think that the New World Order has got to do with something that's going to be happening on the surface of the planet, but it's not. All right? The New World Order is something that was created when John F. Kennedy was in office. All right? When Kennedy was in office, you know, he was the very first one to implement the New World Order. This is when all of the countries worldwide began digging underground. It wasn't only Kennedy as a so-called elite, what they called the Reptilian Squad, all right? And they all knew what was going to be taking place. Back in the 60s, they say we have very little time left. So, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, this is when they began digging underground, digging into the mountains, all right? Donald Trump's great-great-grandfather was into time travel, all right? He was able to, he was guided by an archon who showed him a portal right outside of Russia, and they went into this portal because they wanted to know the truth. And this portal took them into the future. All right. It wasn't so much that their bodies went into the future, but they were able to link into the energies of this portal, and they saw the future and they saw what was happening. And they saw, he saw that his great, great grandson, or either great, 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 whichever one it is, grandson, was going to be president, but he noticed that when, while he was president, it was going to be the end of all. So there's a book that was written, it's at Amazon. I haven't bought it yet, but I saw a video on YouTube, and I pretty much got a gist of what it was, but I saw the video on YouTube, but it talks about everything that's taking place right now. It talks about the virus, the virus and all the other stuff, and it talked about, it said, and Trump was the last president. And the book, the name of the book on the, from that's on Amazon is called The Last President. So what we got to understand is this new world order is not a new world government on the surface of the planet. It's a new world government that is underground. All right. When I did that one video, some of our people were skeptical about, you know, called the Anunnaki Reptilian Classified. Listen to that. I'm going to post it in the description box. I want you to listen to it carefully because it talks about the New World Order. All right. It talks about the original people. It talks about beings of other worlds. And it says, you know, these beings of otherworldly powers. It talks about everything that's happening right now. You know, they just saw a ship leave the sun that was bigger than the planet. They're scared, and it's heading straight towards our planet, all right, our realm, our planet, our home. So we got to understand that this is the end of all things that we know at this point right now. The New World Order has nothing to do with us. It is a new world that is being created underground. It is a new world that was created to suffice their people. So why we say, you know, 10 miles is a long stretch. You know, I don't even know how many feet 10 miles is. 10 miles is a long stretch, but it's 10 miles wide. This whole system is 10 miles wide, and it goes from Washington, D.C. all the way to Arizona, touching California, but not really going into California. Okay, so the key point is that this is a new world they have created underground for their people and their people only. The so-called elite, the celebrities, you know, and all of their regular orc people who classify under certain clearances, family members, and bloodlines. All right, they're going to come and get their own bloodline. And if you're not a part of that blood, if their people are not a part of that elite bloodline, then they're not going. You got to be a part of that elite bloodline. There's a lot of these orc beings here whose forefathers were elite, but they're dead. So because they're dead, they're basically non-existent to them. They don't care. You don't have a bloodline. Your bloodline is gone. You know, we're the bloodline now. So all these orc people who are under the bloodline of the so-called elite, the current elite that's standing there, they're going to be on the ground. So it's all over the world. The thing about it, this new world order is all over the world. All right? So it's underground, Russia, Singapore, London, China, Australia, you know. They've got an underground world for Australia, for the Australians to go. You know, Australia. You know, all in Australia, you see the homes that are built inside the side of the mountains, where they can shade themselves away from the heat. All right, so that's a part of the new world order. You know, it's got nothing to do with anything that's happened here on the surface of the planet. The new world order is underground. You know, they've got some 70, 80 years of food already stored up. Refrigerators, they got tennis courts, basketball courts. There's no football, soccer, where they can play soccer. They got restaurants and all these whatever they call their homes. All right. They got all of that already together. So a lot of those people, when they hear the boom, boom, they go, what is that? What is that? Shaking the ground. That's them. They're making new, opening up new spots. They use limestone. It's called key limestone. That's what it's called. It's called key limestone. It's the hardest rock material known in the world. And they use key limestone to hold up these caverns that they've created for themselves. Underground worlds. All right? So this is what the New World Order is about. Like we said, the coronavirus, there is a virus. There is a coronavirus that is happening right now, all right, where it attacks the immune system and it causes the mucus to multiply in the body of acidic beings, not alkaline beings, but acidic beans. This coronavirus cannot hurt alkaline beans because there's an alkaline-based bacteria, right? So if because it's alkaline-based, it doesn't affect us, but it attacks the acidic beans. That's why all you people in China, all over the world, Singapore, Korea, Russia, all that. And a lot of places, they're not even reporting what's going on because, like I said, this bacteria is coming from meteors and it's coming from glaciers that are melting because everything is returning back to the original way it's supposed to be. All right? So there is a coronavirus. There is a virus, but it's not as big. What's going on? You got radiation coming up from the ground, and a lot of their people are getting cancer from the radiation coming from the ground. You got the frequencies that are high on the planet right now, and a lot of their people they can't even they call it a tinnitus, and the tinnitus medicine is not even helping. And the frequencies are getting so high, they're having strokes and heart attacks. We talked about the drug abuse. All these different illicit drugs that they're creating, and they're dying from it all over the planet. All right? The drug abuse, the homicide and suicide, the homicide and suicide rate among these orc beings are so high, it's crazy. It's an astronomical rate all over the planet. So they're dying from this also. All right, they're dying from the suicide homicide. The first time these beings see things that are starting to emasculate itself. The money is no more. This energy is going crazy on the planet. This is happening. That is happening. This is happening. This is happening. And the first thing that they do when they see change coming in, they can't take change because there's animals. You know, a lot of animals, especially the dogs, they can't take change. A dog would kill itself if it see too much change. Literally, it would kill itself. So they see change. And they go and kill their children and their spouses and kill themselves. They're not talking about the suicide homicide rate. They're not talking about the doctors who are misdiagnosing their own people, and people are dying from misdiagnosis from pharmaceuticals. They're not talking about that. But they blame everything on the coronavirus. But they're dying at a rapid pace. And this is what Donald Trump's great-great-grandfather saw when he went into that time portal. This is what he saw. And he came back and he wrote a book. This is what I saw. And this is what's going to happen. And my great-great-grandson, Donald Trump, will be president. But he's going to be the last president. He's going to be the last president of this United States above. That's why did Trump say, I'm going to be the president for the next 12 years? Why did he say that? Because he's going to be president in the New World Order underground, the New America. So all of our people are still under this assumption that this New World Order is all about us, and they're gonna do it. They got FEMA camps and all that because they're trying to depopulate, and they're mostly gonna try to hit their people, and then they're gonna attack us. But they're very lenient and want to come to us. So best believe, brothers and sisters, you see these motherfuckers want to talk about quarantine in our neighborhoods and all that. Y'all get ready to fight these motherfuckers. They don't want to stand up against us. They know who the fuck we are. Y'all stand up in all y'all power. So believe me, I'm standing up. We ain't doing that shit. We ain't falling for that shit. That's why we fight, going for dark energy. You know, I was talking to a brother not too long ago on the phone. We were talking, and, you know, he's like, well, you know, what's going on? What's going to happen and all this stuff? I say, you know, you understand. You know, he say, are they going to still fight us? I say, they're already planning on fighting us. All right? That's what the movie Terminator was about. Terminator was about artificial intelligence on the surface of the planet fighting against the original people on the surface of the planet while everyone else was, well, all the so-called elite and their celebrities and all the other politicians and all were all underground. Yeah, they have birthing centers and they got electricity. The electricity is running on natural energy. They got copper and iron rods. Your black pipe is iron, all right? They got copper rods and iron rods going some 20, 30 feet in the ground, all right? And they tapping into natural energy to charge up their whole world, new world underground. There will be no light bills and all that stuff. They got, like I said, they got enough food for all their people to last for about 80 years. We give them about 10 years. Because by within that time, we'll have already found out how to get in, break in through their gates, because they're gonna have their gates all sealed off. But they got their little sun simulators and all that and all this stuff here. They got all kind of stuff down there. You know, I've been down there. They got all that stuff down there. You know, food courts and all kind of stuff. They can drive. They got bicycles. They got a whole lot of electric vehicles. Lots of electric vehicles, because you know the thing about it is they can't really drive with that fuel, because that fuel is going to overcrowd. All the gases from the fuel don't have anywhere to go. So they have a lot of electric cars. That's why they went through building a lot of electric cars worldwide. But all of these countries, all right, well, you see these flags, these European countries, these flags, they have underground cities already made up for their people, so-called elite. This is what the New World Order is about. There's a bill that's already made. And I don't know if it's going to happen this year or if it's going to happen next year. I'm not sure. But there's a bill that was already passed where they're going to be releasing all of our people from the prison system. See, there's no reason to keep our people in the prison system, because there's no one, they don't need us to work for them anymore, because they've got all the work out of us that they needed. And they're going to go on the ground. So all of our people who are in this prison system for all these years, all going to be released. The prison system is going to be shut down, and all of them are going underground. That's the New World Order. Now we're going to have to deal with our damaged people. They're going to have to be rehabilitated in the laws of nature, because there will be no laws up here. There will be no police departments and courts and child support and all those other garbage. There won't be that. There won't be no hospitals and that you have to pay for and all that. We're going to have to get ourselves together and come together as a people and find out what we're going to do. What we're going to do with all the trash. You know, what we're going to do with all these abandoned, vacant buildings everywhere. There's going to be buildings everywhere vacant and abandoned. What are we going to do with them? We already know that the species are coming to... The species that eat on metal are coming to devour a lot of these buildings, but we're going to be left with the smaller buildings everywhere. What are we going to do? You know, so we got a lot of our planet to clean up. They're going to leave the surface in ruins. Well, our people, once they live in houses, they can't live in anymore because there's banks. There will be no more banks. There'll be no more money. This grocery store and massive food and cans. What are we going to do with the trash? We got a lot of stuff to think about, my people. We're going to have to dig holes in the ground and burn the trash or something. We're going to have to do something. You know, we're going to have to, because we got to clean up. There's a lot to clean up. Plus, on top of that, there are people who are going to be dying in the streets. We're going to have to bury their asses if they're not evaporated by certain energies. But
we're going to have to bury their asses. Because they're going to start, everybody's going to start stinking. The New World Order is a new world that's underground. That's a New World Order. Got nothing to do with us. Doesn't affect us. Not at all. This is their new world. Because they knew that these days were coming right here where all these planetary bodies return of the gods of old returning to our planet. They knew that this was happening. So like I said, there is a coronavirus. There is a virus out there. But it's not as escalated as they say it is. What's happened among the people? You know, we talk right here in Michigan. The Arabs are dying from the opioid crisis. They're dying. All those people in Asia, China, thousands upon thousands of them are dying a day from opium overdose. But they're blaming on coronavirus. Like we talk about this new drug these earth beings got out here. They're dying every 5 minutes, but they blame it on coronavirus. Why the coronavirus? Because their population is depleting by the day. So they have to create a giant hoax. Like I said, there is a virus out there, but it's not as big as they say it is. Their biggest virus that they have right now is their own self-destruction. And they can't stop it. They can't. It's inevitable. Because they're not strong beings. They're not beings of strength. First time they see something going wrong, they're so weak. What do? They kill themselves. They're not strong like us. All these businesses and money and I got to do this and I got to do that. It's not going to be anymore. We literally have to going to have to return to nature. We're going to have to get out there and plant gardens and all that. Yeah, I was talking to a young brother at the workplace. I said, you know how to plant a garden? You know how to work a garden thing? And he looked at me. He said, well, you know, first you got to get some dirt. That's when I knew something was wrong with them. He said, first you got to get some dirt. Our young people don't know anything about planting. Our young people don't know anything about creating. All they know is I got to sit in front of this video game, play this video game all day long. They're not using this YouTube university while I'm still here to learn how to build things, how to create, how to plant gardens, how to create technology. They're not doing that. They're so far from it because they've been shaded by an illusion. But like I said, when these brothers get out of prison, now one thing about these brothers and sisters when we get out of prison, while they're in the prison system, they have knowledge. They've been taught different things. They're in the science field. They're in the architectural field. They're in the engineering field. Oh, yes. And the prison system got some smart brothers that's doing life in there, and they're creating all kind of things in the prison system. You think it's being created in China. It's not. It's being created in the prison system by our brothers and sisters. They're doing life in prison. Oh, yes. This is where they get so much of the technology from. Our people locked behind bars. You got brothers and sisters who are in prison, and they walk among us. And they're at seminars and all that, and they're taking down information, and then they're going back to their prison cells, where they go there and write out different things and create things because they're enslaved in their mind. They're enslaved. They're locked up. Physically and mentally at the same time. And all they know how to do is create for these work beings. So this whole New World Order thing was all created through these beings making sure that we were locked up. I think they get the idea of go underground. We did it. Let's show you how to do it. I'm going to show you how to use this right here. They get other knowledge from us. Brothers and sisters, they get their knowledge from us. That's where they get it from. So, yeah, this new world order is a new world that's underground. New Bill of Rights, new birthing centers. And they've got the technology where they could communicate with each other underground also. All these, this internet, that's connected from U.S. to England, you think they're connected through satellites? Nope. They're long cords, cables, that they got deep underwater. They use submarines to run these cables from the United States to England, to Europe, to Africa. They run these cables, deep, deep underground cables, communications cables, telephone, technology.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. They got all these cables, all these different technological cables underground, underwater, I'm sorry, and they run these cables from land to land. That's how they communicate with each other, and they set that up for the New World Order. So that everything falls, they still be able to communicate with each other. That's why you're able to see when we use this internal networking system, and you FaceTiming a brother from the U.S. and a brother's in Africa, that's because of underwater cables. There's no satellites. There's underwater cables. They don't have that type of technology. They create a satellite. 5G is not even active yet. I talk about the 5G and what it's about, but the 5G is not even active yet. They don't have that. They don't have the technology to activate the 5G yet. And they're already talking about 6G, and they haven't even finished 5G. And the 5G is more so for underground, because they're going to need higher levels of frequency underground than they would need above ground. 5G is an underground technology system. This is all a part of the New World Order. So the New World Order is underground. And we're going to have to figure out how to live again. They've already got an organized world that they're going to be moving into. They got their underground bunkers that they're living in. All these millionaires, all these elite. And the elite know who's family and who's not. Like I said before, they know who's family, and they're going to pick up their family, and they're going to move their bloodline. And we're talking about direct bloodline. We're not talking about indirect bloodline. We're talking about direct bloodlines. They know who they are. And they're going to take them underground with them. It's going to be thousands, hundreds of thousands of them all together. But the rest of the so-called millions of these beings, they're going to be left to the mercy of nature. There will be no plane spray in the sky. There'll be no military, no police. There'll be no more, like I said, no more banks, no more technology, nobody working every day. We're going to have to work every day to create our own systems the way it's supposed to be. And then we'll have to get ourselves all geared up, because they're going to send their artificial intelligence above ground to fight against us, and we're going to have to link into this dark energy. This dark energy is going to be the only hope of destroying this AI machines that they have, that they're going to have for us to have to fight against us. That's what the New World Order is about, the New America underground. Yeah, Donald Trump's great-great-grandfather, either great-great-great, whichever one it is, saw this. When he time traveled in a portal outside of Russia, he saw all of this. He saw everything that's happening. So they're blaming everything on coronavirus, when in reality, it's not coronavirus. It's their people just dying on a massive scale. They're not even talking about their people who are dying from spontaneous combustion right now. Spontaneous combustion is prevalent among their people. Oh, yeah. Their people are dropping dead like flies left and right all over the world. Torso, everything, just burn up. They're not talking about that. Mm-mm. But they blame everything on coronavirus. Like I said, there are a few cases. There's a whole lot less cases than what they say it is. There are a lot less cases than what they're talking about. But it's more cases of drug abuse, and they're dying from these drugs, the new illicit drugs. Who the fuck put fentanyl and ketamine and heroin together? Who does that but them? The opioids. They're mixing opioids, different opioids together. mixing that shit up with all kind of other pharmaceuticals and taking that shit. And this is happening among the Arabic race also. The white-on-white homicide rate is skyrocketing, but they don't talk about it. When they kill each other, they don't put them in jail. They give them house arrest. They put them on house arrest. They say they have a disease or some type of disturbed mind. You know, so when they kill each other, you know, it's a disturbed mind. It's a disease. It's not a crime. But they're killing each other left and right. They don't want to talk about that. They don't want to talk about the cancer that they're dying from. Every day. They're not talking about the heart attacks and the strokes. They're not talking about the doctors, how the doctors misdiagnose their own people and their people are dying on the table. They don't want to talk about that. And you can't really sue because nobody has any money. The banks are failing. The whole system is failing. We talked about that, how the money is disappearing all over the world. So you got to understand that this is what's happening, my people. This is what's happening. The New World Order is an underground world for their people and their people only. All of our people who are playing football players and all that stuff, they're not allowed. Nah. Thank you for playing football with me. Thank you for doing this. This is why you think they're preparing for the new world. Look, they canceled the basketball, baseball, football. They canceled all the other sports and all that stuff. They're preparing to go underground, my people. They're preparing. Something to think about. New World Order is underground and not above ground. New World Order is a system that they created for themselves because they already knew what was going to happen these days. A lot of brothers and sisters are coming out of portals, returning to the planet. Mm-hmm. And we're getting ready for war. All right. All power to the multi-chakra celestial energy beings. Peace to you all.
Enhance your mind. Recharge your spirit. Awaken your soul. Enhancing Awareness Radio. Enhancing awareness with clarity.
As long as you are trying to make progress, you will go up. But up always implies down. So while you are trying to get better and better and better, that means that when you get to the best, you can only go on to the worst. And so you go round and round and round, ever chasing the illusion that there is something outside yourself, outside your here and now, to be attained that will make things better.
And the thing is to recover from that illusion. So a Buddha means somebody who has woken up and discovered that running around this thing may be fun, and it may be good to run around, but if you think you're going to get something out of it, you're under illusion, because you're forever the donkey with a carrot suspended from his own halter. Now then, it goes on to say that there's only one place, one point in this wheel, from which you can become a Buddha, and that's here. The devas are too happy to become Buddhas, or to worry about becoming a Buddha. The Narakas are too miserable. The Asuras are too angry. The animals are too dumb, and the pretas too frustrated. Only in the middle position, the position of man, which is, you could say, the equal position, the position of sufficient equanimity to begin to think about getting off this rat race, only from there, you see, can you become a Buddha. So the position of a Buddha may be represented either as not on the wheel at all or as right in the middle of it. It makes no difference. And so he is just as, in a way, the axle point, the still point of the turning world, as to use T.S. Eliot's phrase, is the unmoved center, the unmoved mover, the primum mobile, the axle tree of the world. Also, the navel, that's why yogis are said to contemplate their navel. The navel isn't on their tummy, it's this place, the navel of the world. So that's the scheme of cosmology. Ancient Indian cosmology in which Buddhism arises. So you see, therefore, a Buddha is one who awakens from the illusion of samsara. That is, from the thought that there is something to get out of life, that tomorrow will bring it to you, that in the course of time it will be all right. And therefore, one is set pursuing time, as if you were trying to quench your thirst by drinking salt water. Now, I can exemplify this a little more strongly by relating Buddhism to the social system in which it arose. A Buddhist monk is sometimes called a shramana, S-R-A-M-A-N-A, shramana. This is closely allied to the word shaman. And a shaman is the holy man in a culture that is still hunting. It isn't settled, it isn't agrarian. There is a very strong and important difference between a shaman and a priest. A priest receives his ordination from his superiors. He receives something from a tradition which is handed down. A shaman doesn't. He receives his enlightenment by going off into the forest by himself to be completely alone. A shaman is a man, in other words, who has undergone solitariness. He's gone away into the forest to find out who he really is, because it's very difficult to find that out while you're with other people. And the reason is that other people are busy all the time telling you who you are in many, many ways. By the laws they impose on you, by the behavior ruts they set on you, by the things they tell you, by the fact that they always call you by your name, and by the fact that when you live among people, you have to be in a state of ceaseless chatter. But if you want to find out who you are before your father and mother conceived you, who you really are, you almost have to go off by yourself. Go into the forest and stop talking, even stop thinking words, and be absolutely alone. And listen to the great silences. And then, if you're lucky, you recover from the illusion that you're just little me, the so-and-so, and you attain the state of nirvana, which means the blown-out state, the relieved state, the sigh of relief. Nirvana may be translated into English as, phew, I've at last discovered that I don't have to survive. I can survive, of course, but I don't really have to. Because you discover, you see, that what you really are doesn't have to survive, because it's what there is. The real you is it, or that, tat tvamasi, that art thou, as the Hindus say. So then, in the normal life of India, which is not a hunting culture, but a settled culture, there are priests, but there is something beyond the priest. That is to say, when a man or woman has fulfilled his or her life in the world of society, it's the normal thing to do for a person to quit their status in society and become what's called a forest dweller. That is almost, you see, to go back to the hunting culture. They divide people into two classes, Grihastha, which means householder, and Vanaprastha, which means forest dweller. And the older people all hand over their occupations and positions to their children and enter the stage of vanaprastha or become a shramana and go outside the stockade. I'm speaking metaphorically. They sometimes do, actually. They sometimes don't. And become a nobody. They give up their name. That is to say, the label which designates who they are in terms of caste or class. They become unclassified people. That's why, strictly speaking, you see, Hinduism and Buddhism are not religions. You can classify the religions. You can say, what's your denomination? Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Quaker, etc., 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 you see. But strictly speaking, a vanaprastha, a shramana, has no label. He is an unlabeled bottle. So, in the time when the Buddha lived, about 600 BC, the Hindu system had become somewhat decadent. It isn't altogether clear what had happened to it, but it is certain that it did seem in some way to be in need of reform. And so there were many reasons for this. And the Buddha, as a young man, being basically troubled by the great problems that we're all troubled with, the problem of suffering, problem of what all this universe is about, he endeavored to follow the methods that were then being used by people who were shramanas or vanaprasthas, forest dwellers. And at that time, it's very apparent that the main method that these people were using was an ascetic discipline. Starvation, very arduous meditation practices, probably self-flagellation and things of that kind. And it's said that for 7 years he practiced these austerities. But he found out that they didn't lead to liberation. And all the people who were practicing them knew they didn't either. But they felt that that was only because they weren't doing it hard enough. And so he propounded instead the middle way, the way that led to liberation from the rat race that I've drawn here, neither through austerities nor through pleasure seeking. See, these are the two ways, the two paths, the people who say the whole point of life is to enjoy it, to get the most out of it, you see. And the other people who tried that, and then they found it was sour grapes or something, you know, or they burned their fingers in the pursuit of pleasure. The girl that was so beautiful eventually fell apart, but it turned into a shrew, and whatever it was. And so they said, instead, let us torment ourselves. A lot of people enjoy this, or get something special out of it. I was in Mexico this summer, and what I went there for was to study Mexican Catholicism, where they make a great cult of suffering. And I was very puzzled about this and wanted to understand it. And everywhere, you know, they have these ghastly, tormented Christs, all drooling with blood, hanging on crosses in very contorted positions. And I realized there are certain people who find that, sitting on the tip of a spike is the realest place in the world. Because when you're on the tip of a spike, you know you're there. There's no doubt about it. And also you know that you're expiating for everything. This, somehow by sitting on the spike, you are paying for your guilt. And so long as you hurt, you're all right. See? So these shamanas were doing something of the same kind. And the Buddha became enlightened. Became a Buddha. He woke up. At the moment when he gave up that kind of quest, the moment he gave up, as we should say, trying to take the kingdom of heaven by storm. Now, what does this mean? that in his time, way of liberation had become competitive, which meant it was on the wrong track. There are a lot of people who, we call it the holier-than-thou attitude, but we find it today with some objectionable Westerners who go over to Japan to study Zen Buddhism and then come home and brag about the great disciplines they've undergone and say, I sat with my legs crossed in one position for 10 hours as distinct from somebody else who only sat for 5. And always there's this tendency, you know, to have a marathon and be in a competition with others or with oneself about these things. But the moment you do that, you're back on the wheel. The best thing you can get by asceticism is to get up to the deva world. You can't get anywhere else by it. You may get down to the Naraka world by asceticism too. Read the story Thais by Anatole France. So he found, you see, that the real path, the middle way, the meaning of the middle way is that it's the path that can't be followed. Because to get you onto the middle way, I have to get into a dialogue with you, you see, and you say to me, because after all, it's always the student that raises the problem, not the teacher. You say, well, now, what's the right thing to do? I say back to you, why are you looking for the right thing to do? And then you have to consider your situation, where you are. And you say, well, I'm looking for the right thing to do because I feel that I'm in the wrong situation. I don't have peace of mind. Why do you want peace of mind? Because my mind is disturbed. And in other words, you as a disturbed mind are trying to find peace of mind. Your quest for peace of mind is the same thing as having a disturbed mind. Now, if you don't have a disturbed mind, you won't ask for peace of mind. Well, how can I quiet my mind? Why are you asking to quiet your mind? Because it's disturbed. You see where you are? So in this way, by this dialogue, the guru, the teacher, brings the person back to center. So then this is the point. All Buddhist teaching is a dialogue. Really and truly, the man who goes out and leaves society and becomes a monk is a little bit too much. Buddhism involves this act as a preliminary gesture. But what it comes to in the end is the position of what's called a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva means somebody who went out of society, or we should say gave up the world in some way, took on the robe, took on the discipline. He found what he was looking for. His finding it was absolutely simultaneous with his coming back into society. And he's called a bodhisattva as distinct from a Pratyeka Buddha, which means a private Buddha, one who goes out and doesn't come back. And the bodhisattva is considered as having a superior attainment, superior insight. So the important thing to remember then is Buddhism is a dialogue. Teaching is a method and not a doctrine. Now, the teaching of Buddhism is summed up in what are called the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, the truth about the origin of suffering, the truth about the ceasing of suffering, and the truth about the way to the ceasing of suffering. Dukkha, D-U-H-K-H-A, dukkha, is the Sanskrit word we translate suffering. Discord, frustration, something like that. That's always the problem, you see. And this, because of suffering, is the reason why human beings seek out teachers and saviors. I hurt, and I don't want to hurt. So that's the universal problem, see, that everybody brings. So then the teacher replies to this problem.
So then the teacher
by saying, you suffer because you crave things. Krishna, T-R-I-S-H-N-A, from which we get our word first. Krishna, right. Craving or desire is the cause of suffering. That's the second truth.
Desire.
Now, the Buddhist analyzes this a bit. He says, the world is dukkha. He says, and it's also characterized by impermanence, anicca, and by non-entityness, anatman. That means that no thing exists independently. Everything is a thing only in relation to everything else. Therefore, there are no separate things, no real selves or souls or egos. And trying to cling to the world, which is necessarily changing, trying to have a separate self and to protect it, all these things are Krishna. They are the cause of dukkha. So the teacher, having said this, then the student comes back and says, well, how do I get rid of Krishna? If Krishna, desire is the cause of suffering, couldn't I get rid of desire so as not to suffer? And the teacher says, well, you try. And this then is the first part of the discipline, to try not to desire, to calm your mind, to practice centering, to practice getting rid of all what they call klesha, K-L-E-S-A, disturbing thoughts, distractions, evil passions, immoderate appetites, and come to upeksha or equanimity of mind. And so the student practices that. And this is a very difficult and arduous discipline. And all the time he sees the teacher watching him with a slightly sour expression on his face. And he knows, of course, or thinks he knows, that the teacher is fully aware of his inmost thoughts. Because, you know, it's the Indian way. They go to meeting with the teacher, and the teacher sits under a tree and smokes a cigarette or a pipe or something, and all the students sit around cross-legged, and they meditate. And sometimes the teacher meditates. And they can see him occasionally looking at them like this, you know. And they think, uh-oh, the teacher knows what I'm thinking. Because he has the power of infinite vision, you see, and all seeingness. And this bugs them completely. Because, you see, you remember how it was in school when you were trying to do something and the teacher walked around and looked over your shoulder? It puts you off completely. And so the Hindu teacher or the Buddhist teacher deliberately puts his students off. And finally, he raises in their minds an insoluble problem. That if you are trying to stop desire so that you will not suffer, aren't you still desiring to stop desire? Students may very well find that out for themselves. And they say to the teacher, but how are we to stop desire when we are desiring to stop desire? So then the teacher can engage them in an extremely marvelous trap, which is to say, he can play it in a number of different directions. One direction is to say, well, don't try to stop all desire, but try to stop as much desire as you can stop. You see where this is going to go. Then they're going to say, well, I'm a little excessive about desiring to stop desire. Well, if you're naturally excessive about it, he says, try to be as slightly excessive as you can. You see? Now, do you see what's leading here? If you follow that course, you are being brought to center. In the same way as I demonstrated before, You're being brought to yourself, to accept yourself as you are here and now.
Totally.
But you can't do that directly. Because if you try to accept yourself, you will always find that in yourself there is a spirit of the non-acceptance of things. And you have to accept that. So the teacher would say, don't try to accept yourself more than you can accept yourself. Accept yourself as much as you can accept yourself. Because then you see you are also accepting the part of you that doesn't accept. Or he may try on another tack. He may say, all right, now, if you've seen that it's that desiring not to desire is simply another form of desire. You're trying, for example, to get rid of your sensuous appetites. You are going to give up booze and women and pâté de foie gras or whatever it may be. And you then think, well, now, yes, this I must do. And eventually you find that you are becoming proud of your success in mastering your appetites. And you're beginning to depend on that. So the teacher says, do you see you're in the same trap as you always were? Formerly you sought spiritual security in booze and women and so on. Now you're seeking it in holiness. Formerly you bound yourself with chains of iron. Now you're bound with chains of gold. Formerly you boasted to all the boys how many sins you committed. Now you're boasting before the Lord of how many virtues you have. Same trap. Why do you do it? Student eventually finds there's no way at all to not desire. Even desiring not to desire is desiring. Even trying to accept oneself is a way of trying to escape from oneself, because one hopes psychotherapeutically that by accepting yourself, you will get rid of your nasty symptoms. So you're not accepting them. You're not accepting them by the gimmick, by the pretense of trying to accept them. So this is the way in which the dialogue of Buddhism begins to work. And as it progresses step by step, let me try and show you a little bit more how it works, because I'm shortening it enormously in order to give you an outline of the whole thing. What is going on between the teacher and the student, the Buddha and his disciples, is not merely a dialogue. There is the verbal dialogue, yes, that goes on. But there also, it spread over a long period of time. And in the intervals, the students are practicing meditations. They are making efforts to control their minds and emotions, and practicing those things which are the Buddhist equivalents of yoga. So that in parallel to the intellectual discussion, there is going on a total devotion of one's whole being to a quest, morning, noon, and night. And so you see this works up a very considerable psychic, it makes the student put a very considerable psychic investment in the task. And as he goes on, you see, he becomes more and more frustrated. Because as the trap closes, and he finds that it's impossible to do the right thing because the right thing is always done for the wrong reason. When the wrong man uses the right means work in the wrong way. You see? There is something you could do to attain liberation, or as the Christian would say, union with God, if you could do it. But the Christian would say, by reason of original sin, you can't. Because through original sin, everybody is basically selfish. And you can't be unselfish for a selfish reason. But you have only selfish reasons. So, to him that hath shall be given. But of course he doesn't need it. From him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. Poor fellow, what is he to do? So you see, in this way, the teacher closes a trap on the student where he finds himself completely impotent. Not only can he not do anything that will bring about his salvation, he is also unable not to do anything. One might say, you must do nothing. You must be completely passive. But you can't do that, because the moment you try to be passive, you're doing something. So you get into the state which they call in Zen Buddhism a mosquito biting an iron bull. Or as we would say in our Western idiom, the state when the irresistible force meets the immovable object. Where something must be done, but simply cannot be done. And in this state of maximum frustration, there is an opportunity to understand the situation. To understand the meaning of the state, I cannot do, I cannot not do. The meaning of the state is that the separate I, which you thought yourself to be, is an illusion. That's why it cannot do and why it cannot not do. You see, what is our I, our ego? Sometime in the development of man, maybe 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago, we developed self-consciousness in a peculiar way. We began to realize that by directed thought, we could control our environment. And then it was, you see, that we had a sense of responsibility. Let's just assume for the sake of argument that there was a time when nobody deliberated. They did exactly what they felt like. When you were hungry, you ate. When you were thirsty, you drank. When you were angry, you hit something. When you were happy, you danced. But you never stopped to think what was the right thing to do. You just trusted your intuition, your instincts, your unconscious, or whatever it might be called. Well, that was great, because nobody worried. Nobody had any problems when it was like that. See, a baby is in the same situation today. Now, maybe you were unsuccessful. Maybe the thing you did spontaneously was absolutely the wrong thing, and the tiger ate you up. Well, that was all right, because it really doesn't matter if the tiger eats you up, so long as you weren't spending your previous time worrying about it. Mm-hmm. See, everybody dies, and if you die clunk like that, that's that. You don't spend all your life before you die worrying about death. You don't spend all your time before you get sick worrying about getting sick. And when you see you move on that level of unpremeditated, spontaneous behavior, that's the golden age. And the reason people look back with nostalgia to the golden age is because that was the time of irresponsibility. But when people began to see that they could provide for the future and that they could look after things and take care and direct everything, immediately anxiety came into the world. See, that was the fall of man. Because then the moment you start doing that, you begin to think. Now, having thought this question through and decided that such and such is the right thing to do, have I thought it over carefully enough? Now, that's a real bugaboo of a question.
You know, you go out of the house and you wonder, did I turn off the gas stove? I think I did. But on the other hand, I'm not quite sure. Let's go back and see. So having gone about 5 blocks, you walk back. Yes, you did turn it off. So you go out again. You wonder again. Now, I wonder if I really looked or whether I was so keen on finding out that I did turn it off that some sort of wishful thinking perverted my consciousness, and whether I hadn't better check that I really did look properly, you see? Well, this way you never get away. You're trapped. So this, you see, is the problem of all self-conscious beings. They feel responsibility, then they feel responsible for being responsible, and responsible for being responsible for being responsible, and there's no end to it. So then in this obscure way, everybody wants to get back to the golden age. But they say, if I just acted as I felt and was completely spontaneous, goodness only knows what would happen. Jesus, you see, said to do that. He did. And everybody reads it in the King James Bible where it means nothing. Take no thought for the morrow. What ye shall eat, what ye shall drink, and wherewithal ye shall be clothed. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. But I say unto you that Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Now if God so clothed the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? Oh, I mean, it sounds lovely read in church. But what it says, everybody says, no, that's the Sermon on the Mount, and that's not practical. Nobody can do that. That may be for a few saints, but after all, in our practical life as we're practicing Christians in the modern world, we can't do that kind of thing. Well, isn't that funny? Why can't you do it? I mean, that's the real reason for saying it in the first place. Jesus said many very strange things. For example, in the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, how the Pharisee goes up into the front row and says how good he is and that he's fulfilled all his obligations and paid the tithe. And then there's this publican who goes into the back and sits there and beats his breast and says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And Jesus says, now that man was the right man. He was justified. But the moment he's told that story, everybody creeps into the back row and says, God be merciful to me, a sinner. And they're all in the front row again. Nobody can do it, you see. That's why the story is told. In the same way, he says, take no thought for the morrow. Stop being anxious, like going to a psychiatrist. He says to you, oh, don't worry me. Stop being nervous. Can you? See, nobody can. And also they find out, you see, that really in the end, nobody can be God. Nobody can make life by being responsible about it. Because whatever you gain in that direction, you lose at the same time. By being responsible, we've created civilization, medicine, care of the poor, everything. But what a headache the thing has become. As we solve all our problems, we make more problems. Every problem you solve gives you 10 new problems. I'm not saying don't do that, but don't think you're going to get anywhere by doing that. That's one way of arranging it. That's one kind of dance you can have, is to improve everything and have technology. But it doesn't really solve anything. And it's only in the moment, you see, when you fully understand that your situation as a human being is completely insoluble, that there is no answer. And if you give up looking for the answer, that's nirvana. And that's how Buddhism works. Existence already includes non-existence. You could say being and non-being constitute existence. Just as we know physically, sound is constituted by sound silence in very rapid alternation. So being, non-being constitute existence. And existence is something of which you may say the game is worth the candle. If it weren't, it wouldn't be. It's like that. Some people try to say there is good and bad with small g and small b, and they together constitute good capital G. Or one might say that humanity is, and the good of humanity, is a curious combination of beneficence and rascality, of reason and passion. And if human beings didn't have those two sides, they would be less than human. Man is in a certain sense redeemed by his passions, redeemed by being something of a rascal. Because if he weren't, he would be like a stew with no salt in it. The salt somehow is something that in a large quantity is horrible, but in a certain small quantity is delightful. And so everybody has to be salted with a certain amount of unrespectability. Otherwise, they're impossible and intolerable. The only thing is, as a fervent cook, don't overdo it. It is in that respect, you know, that it's said of great gurus in India. They have a very funny thing they say. People, Westerners, go over and they meet this man who's supposed to be extremely holy. And they're all agog, you know. And then after spending a few days with him, they begin to wonder. They find he smokes cigarettes. They find that he occasionally loses his temper. And they begin to think, well, is this man so holy after all? I mean, he surely should not be dependent on these little habits and luxuries and so on. And then they find he has a girlfriend. And then they leave because they're so scandalized. Well, then the Hindus say, now you shouldn't get so upset about this, because if this man didn't have a few little vices, he would cease to manifest. He would simply disappear. He has to have these things to keep him grounded, to keep him in the world. Or if suddenly, you know, he gets terribly angry with a certain student and seems to lose his temper, they say, oh, no. That's a tactical anger. That he did on purpose to wake you up to something. It was for your own development and for your own good. He didn't really feel angry at all. Oh, dear. But you see the point. There is something in the fact that if he didn't have these little attachments, he wouldn't be manifesting. He'd simply disappear. There's something in that, only don't take it too piously. I think you get the point. So then, we now have to explore a very important aspect of the Joker as equivalent to Gurdjieff's Fly Man. You see, he points out the four ways, the monk, the fakir, the yogi, and the Sly Man. And all the first three ways are ways of great difficulty. They involve a very, very strenuous discipline. And of course, as we get it through the books about Gurdjieff, the way of the Sly Man involves a discipline too. But I think there's more to be said about the way of the Sly Man than appears in any of those writings, because this is very closely connected with the whole approach of Taoism, the Chinese philosophy of Wu Wei, or non-aggression, and with what is called in Buddhism the middle way. When the Buddha first discussed the middle way, he put it like this. He said, to try and solve the problem of suffering by immersing yourself in pleasure only leads to a hangover. To try and solve the problem by asceticism also brings no liberation. You merely get tied up in a kind of masochism where you say, I know I'm right just so long as I'm hurting. And all that is doing is expiating your kind of infantile guilt sense. So he said there is a middle way between asceticism on the one hand.
Sorry, y'all.
And hedonism on the other. But actually, the middle way is more subtle than that, and it's beautifully discussed in Professor Baum, a book called The Philosophy of Buddha. That's B-A-H-M, Professor of Philosophy at the University of New Mexico. And he gives a very, very fascinating analysis of the middle way in the form of a dialogue, whereby it works simply like this. The student brings the problem to the teacher, and he says, I suffer, and it's a problem to me. And the teacher says, you suffer because you desire. If you didn't desire, you wouldn't suffer. So try not to desire. And the student goes away and says, I'm not very successful in this. I can't stop desiring. It's terribly difficult. And furthermore, I find that in trying to stop desiring, I'm desiring to stop desiring. Now, what am I to do about that? And the teacher replies, do not desire to stop desiring any more than you can. And so the student goes away and practices that. But he comes back to the teacher and said, I still find myself desiring excessively to stop desiring, and it doesn't work. So the teacher says, do not desire too much, not to desire to stop desiring. Now, do you see what's happening? Step by step, almost like Achilles approaching the tortoise, the student is being brought together with himself to the point where he catches up with his own inner being and can accept it completely. And that is, you see, the most difficult thing to do, to accept oneself completely. Because the moment you can do that, you have, in effect, done psychologically what is the equivalent of saying in philosophical or theological terms, you as you are now are the Buddha, just as I was explaining a few minutes ago. That's unbelievable, because we are always trying to get away from ourselves as we are now in one fashion or another. And it's only we will only stop doing that through a series of experiments in which we try resolutely to get away from ourselves as we are. So that is the middle way. But ordinarily, in these other ways, the way of the yogi, the fakir, and the monk, the individual makes a big thing out of the work of liberation, and especially likes the kind of teacher who will put him through the most severe paces. It's interesting how there arise from time to time schools in the West where someone comes along offering people say, look, it's all very well to go to discussion groups and talk about these things. But that's not the real thing. What you need is really to get down and do some work. And often these teachers are very rude and very stern. But people love it. And such a person will always attract a great following. Because people get the feeling, now we're at serious business here. This is really something, you see. And this, you see, though, can be an awful problem.
Let's suppose that you have some difficult and distressing habit, like drinking too much. And you're assured that once you've become the victim of this habit, it's an extraordinarily difficult thing to get rid of it, and it requires intense willpower. And so that kills you right off. You're a dead duck from then on. It's as if you see you had said to the devil one morning, look, I'm going to get rid of you. I'm not going to have anything to do with you anymore. So the devil, who is an archangel and is terribly clever, is all set for you. And because he knows that you are getting out of his way, he surrounds you with greater temptations than you ever imagined. If you are going to outwit the devil, it's terribly important that you don't give him any advance notice. And this is where the work of the sly man comes in. Put it in other terms, in Hindu or Buddhist terms, in the popular terms of popular Hinduism and Buddhism, liberation is getting out of the toils of karma. It's like this. During your many past lives, you've done all kinds of deeds, good and bad, and you are reaping the consequences of these deeds today.
Liberation.
And also today, you're setting up...
Hold on, I have not talked or came in yet, but liberation is getting out of the coals of karma. That is what this radio podcast is about, you guys. It's about, is it escaping the matrix? Is it graduating the matrix simulator? You know what I mean? But that is the whole premise of this podcast, guys. All right.
Consequences. Now, before you can be liberated, you've got to pay off your karmic debts. And so the moment you set your foot on the path of liberation, you are apt to find that all your karmic creditors will come to your door. And that's why it's often said that people who start out on a serious work of yoga suddenly get sick and lose their money and their best friends drop dead and all kinds of ghastly things happen. That's because, you see, they served notice that they were going to do this. And so all the creditors came around. If you're going to leave town and you owe lots of money, you know, you mustn't announce that you're leaving or give a farewell party to your friends because the grocer will find out. So the art of the sly man is to make no contest, but simply to leave without one word. In other words, that's the meaning of Wu Wei in the technical vocabulary of Taoism. Wu Wei, not to interfere, not to force things. That's the best translation of Wu Wei, not to force things. But so he just drops it like that. You're in this respect, you see, you're your own worst enemy. Because even if you serve notice privately on yourself that suddenly you're going to drop it all, already the devil knows, because who do you think the devil is? Now, this lies behind the whole problem that is discussed in the book Zen and the Art of Archery. The necessity of letting go of the bowstring without first deciding to do so. Another way of putting it is that the decision to release the bowstring and the action of doing so must be simultaneous. Not to decide and then act, but to act, decide all at once. Now, why is this? If you are going to be an expert archer, you must shoot before you think, otherwise it'll be too late. You don't aim and then shoot. It's all one action. And this is true likewise of any sort of shooting, pistol shooting as well.
that if you aim, if you decide and then fire, you're apt to do things like pulling the trigger instead of squeezing. All kinds of wrong things are done. And you're always a moment too late if you decide first. You have to act and decide simultaneously. So what does that do, you see? That puts up a very curious problem, which in its own turn becomes a bind. To try and act quickly enough so that you overtake the preliminary decision. To try not to decide first. And that is an impossible problem. I wonder if you ever read von Kleist's story about the fighting bear. This is included in Nancy Wilson Ross's book, The World of Zen, as a kind of Western Zen. It's a story about a man who has a fight with a circus bear. And the bear reads his mind and always forestalls any attack that he makes on it. There's absolutely nothing he can do to get past the bear. And so in the same way, you might imagine a guru who is a mind reader, and he always knows if you decide before you act. And if you do, you see, the devil will catch you. Instead, you see, of deciding that you won't be an alcoholic anymore, the only thing to do is not to drink without any previous decision on this matter. But how can anyone do that, you see? That's the question. How can I decide not to decide? How can I announce that I won't make any announcement without making an announcement? You see, there is no way out of that bind. Try as you may, you go on and on and on, trying, as Herigel did, to release the bowstring without thinking first to release it. But then, strangely enough, one day the thing happened. He did it. And this is involved in our learning of almost all techniques, that we work and work to achieve that final point of perfection. And it doesn't come, it doesn't come, and then one day it happens. Now, what is the reason for that? Is it simply, and this is really, you know, the way it's usually explained, but this is an oversimplification. It is not that we have practiced it so often that it suddenly becomes perfect. It is much more subtle than that. What happens is that we've practiced so often that we find out we can't do it. And it happens at the moment you know you can't do it. When you reach a certain point of despair, when you know that you are the one weird child who will never be able to swim, at that moment you're swimming. Because the desperation and the total inability to do it at all has brought you to a point which we might call don't care. You stop trying. You stop not trying, trying to get it that way. You just have arrived at the insight that your decision, your will, doesn't have any part in the thing at all. And that's what you needed to know. You've overcome, you see, the illusion of having a separate ego. There is no way of telling anyone that that's an illusion. and getting appropriate action, because we are thoroughly indoctrinated with the idea that it's real. And if I say, well, I'm going to get rid of my ego, that's what the Taoists call beating a drum in search of a fugitive. Here's you coming. So the ego, that is to say, the illusion of having a separate will and a separate eye center, that can be an effective agent, that cannot be overcome by a decision which seems to be centered in the ego. You might as well put out fire with fire. It can come only when an attempt to act from the ego center has been revealed to be completely futile. Then the thing happens, because you've really discovered that it was, after all, an illusion. Now, be very careful how you formulate this sort of thing philosophically. This could, of course, correspond to the kind of person who feels unafraid and who feels very free because he's a complete fatalist. A lot of people are, and are very happy in their fatalism. They really feel that they don't do anything, it just happens, and that it's all life, and that when they won't die until it's their time to die, and so why worry? Everything, they have the sense that everything is just happening to them. And this is a kind of a floating feeling. It's as if you didn't have to push things at all. They just float along. Well, now, that state of affairs, that feeling of you don't have to push anything, it just floats along, is very similar to the experience I'm describing, if not the same thing. But this person has interpreted it as a fatalist in a rather passive way. That is to say, he has felt that there still is some kind of a little differentiation between himself as the experiencer on the one hand and that force or set of forces called fate on the other. He is pushed around, but he witnesses being pushed around. Now, in this state, this person still has a little fragment of impurity left. There's still one fly left in the ointment, and that is the sensation of being pushed around. There is still a fundamental division between the knower and the known. And in this case, the case of the fatalist, the knower seems to be the passive thing, and everything known, the objective world or the goings-on of his own physiology, they appear to be the active end. And the knower just has the experience of himself being moved by the tides of life. The important thing to find out is this, that the sensation of being the knower and the experiencer of all this is not, as it were, aside from everything else that's going on, but part of it. Just as you, although you experience your own existence subjectively, you are nevertheless part of the external world. You are in my external world, just as I am in your external world. So in this way, the final barrier between the knower and the known is broken down. There is nobody, as it were, being carried along by fate. There is just the process. And all that you are is part of the process. Then there is a curious flip. The individual who has always felt himself to be the tiny little thing on the end of the big determining process suddenly goes boop. Have you watched sometimes a tiny little piece of mercury coming nearer and nearer to a large piece of mercury? The sudden moment when they touch each other and boop, the little thing vanishes into the big one, almost more dramatically than a drop into the ocean. In this case that I'm talking about, it isn't that the individual organism vanishes. The individual human being doesn't vanish. But he experiences no longer a passive relationship to the world, he simply sees that all that he is and all that he ever was something that the entire process was doing. At the time, in other words, when he felt himself to be separate, he sees that that is, in a certain way, just what he should have felt. Because that was what the process was doing in him, in exactly the same way that it was giving him brown or blue eyes or blonde or brunette hair. And that's going through the door and turning around and seeing there wasn't a door. A finding that you aren't fated, that you're not trapped, because there's nobody in the trap, and it takes something trapped to make a trap.
As experts in online education, Purdue University Global gives you all the flexibility you need to balance school, work, and life.
Wow.
Take classes 100% online to fit your schedule, your pace, and your personal...
Let me see if that's an ad or do we finish? We may have finished. Okay, yeah, we finished that one. So that was pretty much it, you guys. This is going to be an easy podcast. Let's see. This is a good one.
It is time to get uncomfortable.
Why are you doubting what has already been?
within you, within you, within you, within you, you, you. I've been blessed with the death note. What you choose to speak into the book is based on the sharpness of your sword. See, I heard a flower teach the seed about the process of opening up, but the seed buried himself instead. If only it knew the power of water. If only it knew the power of water. If only it knew the power of water. Turn on the light within, turn on, turn on. Turn on the light within, turn on, go. Turn on the light within, turn on, go. Turn on the light within, turn on, come on. Turn on the light within, turn on, go. Turn on the light within, turn on. Turn on the light within, turn on. Turn on the light within. Sukane. Sukane. Suka. Sukane. Yeah. Sukane. Suka. Sukane. Sukane. Suka. Sukane.
Okay, life is an amazing teacher. Life is just an amazing teacher. Are they not done? Wait a minute. I love that though. I love that though. Life, eternal sense that you guys. Life is an amazing teacher. You know what I'm saying? It's truly an amazing teacher. In so, you know, we have these quotes that say everything is a teacher. Life is a teacher. Life is a teacher when we let go of attempting to try to navigate or control how life should go. When we simply allow things and we start to pay attention, you know, and the whole uncomfortable aspect of it, divinity. Divinity is another great teacher, you guys. Oh, my God. I just had to say that real quick, real fast. This podcast, guys, I had something on the schedule, but it was more of a teaching. It was more of a teaching podcast, you guys, but I'm attempting to kind of shy back away from the teaching, you know, because now I'm in the classroom of being a student, you guys. So I'm learning, I'm being a student, and how am I up here teaching y'all, you know what I'm saying, and trying to, you know, make it like I know best or whatever, you know, when I am a fucking student, you guys. So this lecture was one of my personal lectures that I listened to, because I am taking myself back to the basics, you guys. And the whole arenas, thinking that we know it all, thinking that we know best, thinking that we are trying to teach the world this, you know, sometimes I have to pause. And I have to, you know, in transparency, I have to share with you guys that I, too, am still a student. And I have to share with you how I am learning. And this is how I am learning, you guys. I am so busy teaching. I'm so busy trying to help others. I'm so busy trying to manipulate, you know, how things should go for others, when sometimes I have to sit down and take myself and look myself in my own manipulative mirror and do a self-check. This show was a self-check for me because I just had to just stop. You know what I mean? And slow down and listen. That's an unpublished book that I have not published yet. But sometimes you have to stop, slow down, and listen. And the name of this podcast, you guys, is Escaping the Matrix to Not Have to Repeat. Now, this lecture can go a lot of ways. We have the last hour, and Eternal is with us, as you guys know. There's many ways to slice it, but Alan Watts, you guys, Alan Watts is the name of that. Type in Alan Watts
Matter of fact, I'm gonna put it in the show links, guys. I'm going to put in a show link for you guys to have. Let's go ahead and bring Eternal in. Eternal, we got about an hour to discuss. So royalty on to you. Eternal, we can't hear you.
Please.
Can you hear me? Okay, there we go. Royalty. How you feel
Greetings,
today?
How you feel? Oh, got me.
Yeah, how you feel?
You might get out early today. Yeah, I'm doing great.
I'm determined, by the way.
Oh, there we go. Each day, you know, we got a new chapter, we got a new page, a new era in our book. You know how we got to look at ourselves inside and out, and, of course, as above, so below. So that's why, of course, like how you speaking makes Adam and truth to who we call ourselves as Adam and the Adam Project. We assume ourselves. So Muta, or mother, she gave us that breast milk to start thinking and reacting a lot different than how society's taught us. And because of that, this explains the father being the discipline. Why do we have father discipline and mother time? This is to explain how much in nurture and nature that, you know, it's imperative that we find this focus. A lot of us are refocusing ourselves now. The tentacles, I've actually had to massage with one sister, and her limbs are extra limber. Like, what I mean by that is they get double jointed, and let's say you pressing somebody's like leg back, and they can go further than the average, or their finger goes, you know, further than the average. And I found that happening, and I was like, wow, this is amazing, like being able to stretch your finger completely further than the average bend. This is like the pinnacle. This is like, you know, learning your nurture and your nature. How much do you really, you know, tap into your nature that it gets like how we're saying it now? You might have to start all the way over again. Start back from baby form. You know? And I'm glad that
back to
still
the
one of those, one of those movements that you can say, I can still do and still have appreciate love for, like just crawling. You know what I mean? Like, have you ever thought about just recrawling again? You know what I'm saying? You're like, well, what I need to recrawl for? Well, just say that you had to go up under a house, and now you got to crawl in a crawl space, you know? And so it's kind of giving you the, if it was survival tactics, you would know to still what to do versus I don't know what to do kind of thing. The movement is better for us now because the so-called COVID is like another way to look at how we have now more time to adjust ourselves versus go out and do for everybody else right now. If you're doing for everybody else, you're going to have to find out what is it that's going to help you help them without feeling like you're hurting yourself and not feel burnt out from it. So
boundaries.
This is what a lot of us think. You know, it's real reality now. Like, you got to be in the street and do some work versus wait for the work to come to you. Then you got to now go in the house and see how the work comes to you without having to go out. Those are like two different avenues. So an average person, let's say they come to your foundation, they want to use your bathroom. Would you allow them? Would you allow the person to use your bathroom?
Eternal, that leg. I don't know why you do that to me. You always give me, like, when I step off to do something, you always ask me a question. Like, every time. Repeat the question, please.
That's it.
Like, just when I step off.
I said, if you was in your foundation and you used to being outside, now you got to go inside. would you get used to someone that's on an average, not knowing him, but just the average person walking around, saying, can I use your bathroom? Would you let him?
I would not, no.
Even your response before you said it was like, I can't even think about it.
because see, so, you know, I used to could. You know what I mean? I used to could. That's the thing. That's why I'm so
right.
so gung ho now. Because I used to do that.
Right. Yeah. And so now you're knowing that you have a safeguard now versus how you used to not even have that safeguard. It's the same thing with a door. There was never a door on our foundation. We didn't need a door for our foundation. However, we had to have a door
mm-hmm.
for outsiders. Don't respect your foundation.
Mm.
This is why windows was created so you can see it, but you can't come in here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like how we've created a looking glass on ourselves, you know.
Yeah.
And the same looking glass as Alan Watts was speaking on, it's like a desire that can also kill you, basically.
Mm.
Using it in the wrong way or the wrong fashion is the point of saying it could be over you. There was this point in Nemo, right? And there was this little sand crab or some kind of crab, crawdad or whatnot. It was in the water. And it was supposed to be like just basically what they do. They're supposed to clean up and stuff like that. That's why they had it. So it was like an ecosystem. Well, we failed to realize it was the ecosystem. What they did was they kind of glamorized it and dramatized it and put it like us being with a human form with these all kind of personal emotions. He was saying bubbles, bubbles, bubbles. And every time he saw the bubbles, he wanted to close the little chessboard up, I mean, the chess treasure chest up so he can keep the bubbles because he wanted the bubble. And was saying something like on a desire, if you wanted something so strong that you can will it or even kill it in that will. And so like on a joke concept, it was like the bubbles being strong, but he was like, I don't want nobody to get my bubbles. And so he was keeping it to himself. And that's like how society can show us that we might be so strong-willed that we want something to happen, that now we don't want something to happen.
Mm.
Your desires can kill you if you let it overtake you. Now, of course, just like you said with using the bathroom, what does this got to do with using the bathroom? That's good that you have a safeguard. Some of us don't have a safeguard to where at least you might have deciphered it. You might say it in a relativity. You might have said, well, it depends. The person in emergency, whether he's about to go on himself, or it depends. This person got manners. It depends. Should I know this person to have manners? There's a lot of this person going to somebody else's foundation. Would they respect that foundation like they respect where they were at work or whether they were at their own foundation? The characters who we speak of are the characters who keep showing you who they are. And they'll constantly do it. They'll say, I'm an impatient person. There you go. They're letting you know. There's nothing wrong with them telling on themselves. And there's nothing wrong with you responding to what they're saying. Just don't have a response as quick as you hear it.
Okay.
He has some profound concepts to throw out there at you to be like, okay, that's the Buddha that you're talking about. When you talk about Thor, oh my gosh, we can talk about that all day.
Now Thor,
I ain't gonna talk about
it
today.
No, we gonna cut it short. We gonna cut this one short because literally this was just me being a student, you know, today, and I literally need to hear that to get back to the basics. So that's what this was. But you know, I just want to ask you a personal question. What is an example of ways that like escaping the matrix or pretty much, like, what was that transitioning point for you that you felt that you were not, you were in this world, but you were not of it?
That could be like from the beginning when I was at 16 with the high blood pressure, or when it was telling me my left hand was something I shouldn't be using, so I should be using my right hand in fourth grade.
So sick.
Me realizing I had sisters and I'm the only brother in the foundation, had to come up with a mask from somewhere in the picture. And then there's the point of the man having a marriage and you being a stepfather, you never knowing how committed you can be. And then you realize you get ready to have a child and then find out that she had a child already at 17, already pre-major. So you're like, whoa, whoa, how that work? So there's a lot of, if you look at the obstacles, man, anybody could be like this. I don't know how many people be like how I am. But there's just many ways that you can look at. You got a Buddha somewhere hidden inside of you, just might not experience that Buddha style that made you say, I'm in the world, but I ain't of this world. Nah, not like this. That's what even, you know, having the next seed, me having the next seed is a great thing. Just today's society is not so great. Like, we could see how we could change it to be a great earth versus not so great. Because looking at society and based on society and how we live in is like the downfall to a lot of the things we want to get up, you know, up out of. As long as we knew how to get up out of, we'll see the embracement better, you know. It'll clear the actual runway for a lot of the things where we say, oh, man, I don't know what's the difference between the city and the rural area. That's what makes you start to say, okay, I got to start doing that. I got to start going in and where all the grass at and sit in it for a minute. Knowing I'm not going to live here, I just got to sit here long enough, though. The grass is going on over here, you know? Like, don't just be so much in a rush to get things done that you don't take time to put into yourself. And that's what I really was like, this got to be that focus, that fulcrum, because when my uncle passed away, that was like another turning point in my life to say, man, I got to get it together. People are passing around right next to me, and I'm not liking that, you know. And I found that out when I had the high blood pressure and then had to wake up with the realization of other people. Yep.
Yeah, you said the high blood pressure and realization. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, that high blood pressure and realization was the epiphany to start waking up. And it was still like a slow, ongoing process. It was not like an overnight thing, you know what I mean? Because you still want to live like everybody. You want to do what everybody is basically doing. You want to be accepted like everybody in the whole phenomenon. And then you realize that's not you either. You got to say, wait a minute, is this me? This ain't even me. I'm just acting like I'm with this. I like this stuff, but I don't.
So it's
even the music
kind of what I
like doing the hobby. What you say?
Just to kind of pinpoint, you know what I'm saying, for the audience is sickness. It was a hobby. It was a sickness that made you become aware, and also the needing to be different as far as, you know, different from the whole with your sisters. The masculine energy needed to be. So to be different, sickness and to be different is two things I heard you say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it got to a point that the differences would have me stand more on what I have to stand for. I'm still on that.
That's what's going on. Your phone's breaking up.
Okay.
Well, Eternal, I think that we had pretty much, you know, covered everything. You know what I'm saying? This is going to be a short show. So, I mean, if there's, tomorrow's going
to
be
short. He said a lot of stuff,
bro. Yeah,
ain't
he said it. You know, yeah. like you can't. There's yeah. some shit that you just can't touch. You know, like, hey,
right.
I ain't got nothing else
yeah.
to say after that. So we need not ramble on.
yeah, yeah. We talk that. What do you want to do after that? Let's go
All
get
right,
something to eat. That's about it.
All right, you guys. That's it, guys. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We definitely appreciate you guys for tuning in to another podcast of Enhancing Awareness Radio. And Eternal, you can go ahead and take us out, and I guess you can kind of, you know, just leave the audience possibly with something on the lines of what they could do in order to have a mindset of escaping the matrix.
Oh, the easiest thing. Start to stay focused. Stay focused to unfocused. That's what it ends up being. Like, you got to focus so much, you get all focused, and then you're like, wait a minute, what was I doing? Oh, yeah. And I do it so much, right? And because I be like that. If I don't have too much time, I do one more. Now, ironically, I did that in my last two relationships, and I put my neck right into the feminine energy, and she was like, wow, this is amazing. And then it just didn't get any further from there. However, it's still continuous in our people. So I put my head to certain people, let them know that you got that sound, you know, and that sound gives you your mother energy. One second. And then you have the sound, like you say, him. That's more of a energy. So the is more of a soothing, calming. Like, you get hurt sometimes. Sometimes things hurt you, and you need some kind of like consulting. So you might not get your mama to hug you right now. So even when you like hurt, you remember it. Back in the day, you got hit, you like but it was more like you were still comforting yourself, and they said, shut up before I give you some. You something else to cry about. I don't mean to laugh at that. It's just ironic that that's what they would do to, yeah, anyway. So bringing that sound is your charging ability. And if more of us start to just relax your body, get more of a relaxed pose. Don't be so tense in everything we're doing. At certain points, if you feel like you're losing out, that's what he was saying earlier. He was like, if you're losing out, that's the time when it's actually going to actually kick in. So that's where you don't realize giving up is the point of how you get in. So it's the giving up stage that's going to help you realize it's not really you giving up. You put more of the intuitive side to you to make the intermission side work in its activation. Some of the things we are not knowing how it's acting or reacting once we get to the other realm. So it's a point of you got to actually feel confident even when you don't feel confident, you know. I lost my keys, and I started humming. Next thing I know, I found them. There was one point I almost got hit, but I was playing a tune, which I'm going to tune out with that. And it was like, wow, I'm glad I didn't get hit because I was focused on the music, and the music helped me. So when you think about music, find your instruments and play it. So you can be not just in the world, but of the world and in the world in a different level. And so you can help what's missing out of our people. They missing it. They don't know. But it's up to you to help them what they don't know. And knowing is not just half a battle. It's not even a battle. You know what I mean? It's a rock. Manifestation to the race. I say, ooh, give thanks, respect to y'all. Sure.